Pat Cadigan, the queen of cyberpunk, returns to the Plutopia podcast with a new book. Her latest book is a novelization of the classic Japanese sci-fi series, Ultra Seven.
I was one of the very rare Americans who had seen the original Ultraman. And so they asked me if I would be interested in doing the novelizations. And I said, yeah, sure, I'll try anything. And so they got me the DVDs, and I they picked out the stories for Ultraman, but when it came to Ultra 7, they told me to pick out the stories to novelize. So so I did that on Ultra 7. I think that's the big strength of the both of them, of Ultraman and Ultra 7. It's not just that, you know, he's such a powerful hero, but he's got people who have his back.
Hey everybody, welcome to the latest episode of the Plutopia News Network podcast. I'm John Lebkoski, your co-host. We have other co-hosts, too, including Scoop Sweeney, my partner in crime, and Wendy Grossman, who is one of the great co-hosts. And we have as our guest today, Pat Cadigan. Pat is a science fiction fantasy.
Yeah, she decided to show up.
Oh, yeah. Pat's a science fiction, fantasy, and horror writer. A three-time winner of the Locus Award, two-time winner of the Arthur C. Clarke Award, one-time winner of the Hugo Award. Which
well,
is
one so
one.
Far. I'm optimistic.
Yeah, we're waiting for that next one for sure.
Yep.
And she is also known as the Queen of Cyberpunk. And the day that we actually originally scheduled this for the day that her latest book is being released. So it was released just a few days ago. It's called Ultra 7. And it's a novelization of the Ultra 7 television series that was super popular in Japan and pretty popular in the USA too. How's it going, Pat?
Oh, not too bad. You know, it's we've been suffering from a couple of heat waves over here. And we didn't have bad heat today, but it was extremely humid. So there's that. I've become such a Londoner. I talk about the weather right away. No, I've just been, kind of sitting around doing research, catching up with my reading and working on some short fiction for the moment.
I was wondering about how you got into the Ultraman, Ultra 7 universe. Was it because you had done novelizations before, or was it because you're the queen of cyberpunk, or was it both?
Well, I don't know if it was so much the cyberpunk, but I had, it was the same publisher that I'd done a number of novelizations for, and they asked me if I was interested. And they were particularly interested in having me do it because when I was 13 years old, I used to run home from school and watch Ultraman on channel. I can't remember whether it was channel 56 or channel 38 out of Boston, but it was one of the UHF channels back when we only had three channels, maybe four if you were extremely lucky.
I grew up in New York. We had a lot more than that, actually.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's like if you were outside a big metropolitan area, and I was like 50 miles northwest of Boston, so there wasn't a whole lot of choice, although we did get the benefit of some of the New Hampshire channels.
Oh, stupid. I grew up with three channels. On a good day, we had three channels.
When I moved to Ithaca, New York, they had no local channels at all. The nearest local channel was 40 miles away in Elmira.
Hmm.
And so they got cable in the 1950s. It was one of the first places ever to get cable because this guy said, figured out he could sort of pick up stations from Syracuse and Elmira and stuff and run a repeater and fan them out to
orbit. Yeah.
So that was where cable came from, was places like Ithaca.
Yeah. Well, we didn't have anyone who was handy with a repeater or anything, but I was one of the very rare Americans who had seen the original Ultraman. And so they asked me if I would be interested in doing the novelizations. And I said, yeah, sure, I'll try anything. And so they got me the DVDs, and I they picked out the stories for Ultraman, but when it came to Ultra 7, they told me to pick out the stories to novelize. So so I did that on Ultra 7.
It did feel to me like the chapters maybe followed individual episodes.
They did.
Yeah. I never saw the show. I never heard of it before.
No, I actually found it on Pluto TV and watched some of the episodes.
Yeah,
they're
fantastic. Oh, I was lucky enough to see a lot of the early anime and science fiction from Japan, because I moved from Texas to Berkeley, and the public TV stations in the area were beginning to get a lot of this stuff. They initially it was all subtitled, but I was entranced by this stuff because I'd never even heard of it. And Ultra 7 was one of the ones that they came out with, and it was pretty amazing considering the stuff on regular TV was pretty awful.
Yeah, I was just I was just enchanted because it was. It was from elsewhere, it might as well have been TV from another planet for me, because I'd never been anywhere, and it hadn't occurred to me that other countries had their own science fiction, because I was callow youth. But
Japan is such an interesting culture, and their science fiction is so weirdly Japanese.
It turned out my son developed a real fascination with manga and anime when he was still in diapers, and he grew up to get a master's degree in Japanese cultural studies, and in fact he's in Japan on his birthday vacation with his girlfriend, and they said they wanted to spend 10 days in Japan. So I think they're in Tokyo and then in Kyoto for a few days, and then they're coming home. But I got the anime on the UHF channels as well. We got Tobor the Ape Man and Kimba the White Lion and Speed Racer. And I was amazed, and I thought, why don't we do cartoons like this?
Kind of immersing myself in Ultra 7 this time and the whole Ultraman kind of universe and experiencing the TDF, I realized that I kind of like fiction that's about teams, teams that work. And well, that's a pretty good team.
Well, that I just did, finished a few months ago filming a... some segments for a feature on Ultraman, and of course they asked me, as an American, the Tsuburaya Studios sent over a small film crew, and they asked me, about the differences in between American science fiction and Ultraman. And I realized that one of the big appeals of Ultraman was the fact that he had an ideal workplace. He had a team. He had people that he worked with And they all really liked each other, you know, and they all really helped each other. And so it was funny to me that you mentioned that, because I think that's the big strength of the both of them, of Ultraman and Ultra Seven. It's not just that, you know, he's such a powerful hero, but he's got people who have his back, you know.
It's interesting because there's so much American television that follows that template now. I mean, if you look at, you know, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, mm-hmm. or Angel, that's the same thing. They have, they're the star, but they have a whole team around them.
Yeah.
And it always seems to me that the secret of American television is that every show is about a family of some kind, whether it's an office family or a police family or, there's always this kind of idea that you have this group of people who are, you know, attached in some
way. Yeah.
Well, you know, the earliest film I can recall seeing, and one of my favorite films, I've watched it, you know, dozens of times, that features this kind of team dynamic, is The Thing from Another World. Mm-hmm. And I'm not talking about the John Carpenter version, but the earlier version that Howard Hughes produced and Christian Bobby directed. And I'm sure you're real familiar with that.
Yeah.
That was such a great team, and they had such a great sense of humor throughout the, I mean, they're, as far as they know, they're going to die and everybody on Earth is going to be invaded, and soon the vegetable people are going to take over the Earth. But they have a great sense of humor.
Yeah. Yeah.
and they work well together.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm laughing about that now because it's been a long time since I saw the original movie. But I got a big kick out of the John Carpenter version, even though there isn't an ounce of estrogen in it.
I noticed that. They fixed that, though. They did a a prequel. Yeah,
yeah.
Prequel had some estrogen.
Yeah, I mean it. I really like the movie, but it really dates itself. You know, it's like if it were made now, you know, half the characters would be female. Maybe one or two of them might even be non-binary, you know. There'd be gay characters, you'd have the rainbow.
Yeah, but on the other hand, the men would get most of the lines.
Yeah, probably.
Well, and it was pretty accurate to the book compared to the old Thing from Another World, which was completely unlike the book.
Yeah. I got asked to do the novelization because I'd had some pretty successful novelizations. In fact, Ultraman won a Scribe Award for best adapted novel from the International Association of Movie and TV Tie-In Writers. I think that's the full name of the organization. It's a great organization. They have several different categories that they give awards in, and they're all juried awards. They ask for volunteers and their members to, you know, to do the reading and make the decisions. So, and you get a different group judging the awards every year. But and they're all, you know, really experienced tie-in writers, so they know what they're looking at, and God, they all work so hard too.
I was thinking about the earliest novelization, like tie-in book that I read was Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea by Theodore Sturgeon, and he did kind of a bang up job with it. It was really well done, and I mean, it's a very interesting field, I think, to be in. And I, do you think about, like, in your mind, who do you think is the audience for that kind of book, especially like for the Ultraman Ultra 7 books?
Well, I think in terms of, you know, when I was a kid, the first tie-in I ever owned was Robinson Crusoe on Mars. And, you know, this was back in the days when dinosaurs roamed the web. You know, we had DARPANET and nobody knew about it. And so having that tie-in book allowed me to carry the movie around with me and dip into it anytime I wanted to. And I really, really liked the movie. And I think I read that book until it actually fell apart. But I always think in terms of people who want to have the movie at their fingertips, but also you usually get a whole lot of detail and you may get twists to the plot that you don't see on the screen. And it's because there's such a big lead time for books that while you're writing the novelization, not for something like Ultraman, but for I did the novelization of Alita. They change the script, or they make, you know, it's like they make changes, or they suddenly decide to make changes while you're writing the book. So so the finished product doesn't always adhere to what people see on the screen, and a lot of people don't understand why. And that's why, it's because I did adhere to the script. I adhered to the script they gave me. And meanwhile, while I was writing it, they changed the script.
Well, I was researching, you know, Ultra 7 online, and I discovered a version of that that I doubt you'll be able to do a book on, because it was the Ted Turner version of the series, because Turner Program Services signed a contract with the producers, and they sent him a English dubbed version that was done in Honolulu, and this was in the mid-70s. Mm-hmm. And they did not like that, so they got a group from the Canadian Children's Programming Production Company, CINAHR, to do dub all 49 episodes.
And wow.
It was apparently so horrifyingly bad that they just put it in the locker and left it until it I think the contract finally ran out in 2001, and they had to give all the stuff back. But fortunately, it never saw the light of day.
Yeah, that's that'll happen.
Yeah, but that happens to a lot of sci-fi stuff that should be given great treatments, and they end up stinking.
Yeah. So,
have you ever heard of Brad Warner?
The name sounds familiar.
He's a Buddhist teacher, I guess you would say, who is mostly online. He's like, he does YouTube videos, and he does like maybe a video a week on the subject of Buddhism. But the interesting thing about Brad Warner is that he actually worked on Ultraman. He worked for Tsuburaya Productions when he was living in Japan, and you know, mm-hmm. he was in Japan, and I think he originally went over there to be like an ESL teacher, and mm-hmm. and some, but he was a big fan of Japanese science fiction films and television series. So he managed to get a gig with Tsuburaya, which he talks about from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought I'd toss that in as a point of trivia.
Well, apparently the man who started it, Mr. Tsuburaya himself, was a convert to Catholicism. He was a devout Catholic. I found that interesting.
I had heard that, yeah.
And you sort of see echoes of it in that, you know, it's like people are kind to each other things like that. But it's not, there's not a lot of heavy religious symbolism in it. It's all very it's actually rather well done, you know. Mr. Tsuburaya kind of lived his convictions rather than, you know, talked about them.
One of the things I have to say, just from watching those, like it occurred to me, I could almost certainly find a place where I could stream Ultra 7, and sure enough, I found it on Pluto TV, and I was able to turn on subtitles and stream it that way. It didn't have a dubbed version, but I watch one of those episodes, and you just feel good when it's over. You know?
Yeah. You know, it's like terrible stuff might happen, but people rise to the occasion. And like you said, there's a team, and the team always works together, and they look out for each other. And because they look out for each other, they look out for us.
It's a little hard to take the monsters and the aliens completely seriously.
Well, that's true. That's true. And one of the Ultraman episodes makes use of a convention that none of the other episodes does. And it's the second episode in the original series of Ultraman. One of the characters breaks the fourth wall and addresses the viewers. And they had wanted me to novelize, you know, this was one of the stories that they wanted me to novelize. So I handled that by having the character talking to his phone or talking to a recording device because he was doing a vlog, a video log. And it worked out rather well. But there is also so other things that I had to, you know, that you have to fix because times have changed, you know. There are certain things that we know about that we didn't know at all back when the series was first being produced. So I had to fudge some of the science or just change it and update it.
One of the things that bothered me was that when they rescued Hiro Satsuma from the mine, they didn't get the mouse.
Oh, well, they did. Yeah. In the original script, they did.
Oh, I missed it. I didn't see it. I watched that episode, and I saw them kind of hustle him out of there. It's kind of interesting. It's much easier to tell in reading your version of it, the conflict that Dan Marabushi has, in that he and this guy are like, he's a replica of this guy.
Yeah.
It wasn't as obvious or as clear in the actual series version as it was in your novelization.
Well, I think that's it may not have been clear to us as non-Japanese people, but it may have been much clearer if you were a Japanese viewer.
They were kind of subtle in the way they showed Morobashi's reaction, as I recall.
Yeah.
But yeah, I get it. The other thing was that like nobody else noticed, but partly because Zero was, I think his face was covered when they pulled him out of the mine.
Yeah, that was something that Dan Moriboshi did. He said, "Oh, he's been underground. His eyes will hurt," so they covered his face, you know. And but also when they bring him up and they check on him, they don't immediately notice a very strong resemblance between Dan Murabashi and his original, because Dan comes up wearing a helmet, and that changes the perception of someone's features. You know, it's like you could have identical twins, and if you have one wearing a helmet and the other, you know, just without any sort of head covering at all, they won't look as identical. At least that's my theory. Maybe I just need better glasses.
It's kind of interesting, this whole concept of somebody taking on the form of another person, or an alien taking on the form of another person, and those various powers that they have. That, you know, one interesting thing about it is that because we're so conditioned, though, from years of consuming science fiction, we sort of take these things for granted, and they don't seem at all strange.
Yeah, we take a lot of fantastic developments in stride, but that's the other part of sort of smoothing out the novelization. They didn't want me to date, you know, to give it a solid date to when this was occurring. So it the setting is in the near future or in the future, but we don't know how far in the future it is. It's far enough that that there's more space travel, and in particular, they are more used to the idea of menaces coming in from outer space. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, they make the assumption that there's a whole diversity of aliens in multiple planets throughout the universe. And a lot of us have come to sort of like assume that that would be true, and alien visitations may be happening and so forth. But but it's pretty explicit in something like Ultraman, Ultra 7, where you're dealing with aliens quite a bit. It's kind of interesting, in the new Superman movie, they make quite a bit of the fact that he's an alien. I guess he's an illegal alien, really. I don't think he ever got his papers.
I think that's a little dig at the American way.
Indeed, yeah. But I don't know. How do you feel about aliens? Have you ever met one?
Well, it's possible. You know, I wouldn't say with any great certainty that no, I have absolutely never met an alien. It's very unlikely that I've met an alien. On the other hand, you know, there are some differences that make all of us who actually are from this planet rather alien to each other. And I know now in America, a lot of people are feeling like, you know, they're under hostile alien rule. And
Scotland felt like that about England for a long time.
They haven't totally let go of that particular feeling. But the Scottish profile is very, very different, very separate from the British. But
I recall wondering when I was younger, exactly why the Germans allowed things to go as far as they did, you know, with the Third Reich.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm getting a sense of it.
Yeah.
It's a little easier to understand now.
Yeah. And it's, but it's no easier to live with.
No, it's terrible.
Well, one of the things that, that I've noticed, to my great unhappiness, is that stupidity and hate are contagious. And they tend to, they tend to spread worse than COVID.
Fear is contagious too.
Oh yeah.
Well, the stupidity and hate that's coming out of Washington now is threatening the source of, at least my introduction to great science fiction and great public broadcasting productions that are probably going to be much less available in the country because they've dropped all funding for public broadcasting and national public radio. And those were the places, those stations were what were disseminating the early, anime and science fiction. My first British comedy and British science fiction was all on PBS. And it's just a shame to see that being attacked as being some sort of subversive channel. And it's not really that. It's just different.
Yeah, I'm mystified, actually, because I grew up, when I was growing up, my mother used to tell me that the big strength about America is that everyone can have their own opinion, and you can't persecute anyone for holding a particular point of view. And the whole idea was, I disagree with everything you say, but I'll defend to the death your right to say it. And we no longer have that.
And I think Trump would probably say that you can't persecute somebody for having a different point of view unless they're a Democrat.
Yeah, unless it differs from his.
Yeah, it differs from his, right?
Yeah, but I've also have never heard an American politician say that he hates a particular group of people. Goldwater used to make fun of Democrats and liberals, but I never got the feeling that that Barry Goldwater hated, the loyal opposition. I'm not sure how we got onto this.
I'm not sure how much of it is hate. There's an awful lot of opportunism around.
Yeah,
where it's where there are people who just really don't care what they say about other people.
Yeah, the whole thing about, it's like Trump's big strength is that he doesn't care. He doesn't care if he hurts your feelings.
Well, I wonder if we find ourselves living in a real dystopia here. Somebody's going to say, well, this was the way it was supposed to be. I read about it in a book by Bruce Sterling.
Oh, good. We can blame Bruce.
Or William Gibson, or John Shirley, or Pat Cadigan.
I don't think anyone can really blame me for that.
But is this kind of a cyberpunk reality that we're in?
It's not as cyberpunk as cyberpunk. If you've seen the Oval Office lately with all the cheap gold accents and decorations, it's very cheesy. It's more like 1970s Vegas.
I was going to say, I think of it as the Las Vegas version of the White House.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, and that's definitely not cyberpunk. It's,
I'm trying to think of a clever name for it.
Medieval brothel.
Brothel punk. No, it's not even really, it's not punk. It's tacky.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. There was an interesting thing that happened the other day. I guess it was the World Cup. I guess the U.S. won the World Cup. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I saw the footage.
So they had this trophy that they were holding up, and Trump was there, and the FIFA guy was trying to get him to step aside so the team could, like, do their victory dance. And Trump didn't really want to move very much. He finally got kind of shoved to the back. But what I heard after that was that the trophy they were holding up was not the real trophy, because Trump had already commandeered the real trophy to take back to the Oval Office.
Yeah, yes, he took it. And they have to make do with, you know, a replica trophy, which I think is, that's the height of tacky. You know, that's, ugh.
Well, you know, it sort of tells the story, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think I said before, you know, I think the last time I was on, I find the Trump presidency harder to deal with than cancer.
I was going to say, I don't think that he would have gotten away with it at Wimbledon. I think the All England Club has its methods of making sure the original trophy stays where it belongs.
Yeah. Yeah, I think someone would have
relieved him of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, also someone would have knocked him off the platform too.
But it would have been very subtly and genteelly done.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, it's like they've been doing things like that longer over here than in America. You know, it's if it's 70 years old in America, it's old, you know, whereas here, if it's 70, it hasn't even reached puberty yet, you know, 700, you know, they've been at things longer here. So they, you know, they've developed techniques.
Yeah, you have to recalibrate your idea of old when you come to Britain, and then you have to recalibrate it again if you go to Rome, because everything there makes everything here look new.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I remember the first time I came to London in 1989, I was walking around with a friend, and we walked through part of the Roman wall. And my friend said, "Oh, and these are Roman ruins," and it hit me hard. I had to stop and sit down for a minute, because it's not that I've never seen anything old. I've been to a million, you know, museums, and I've seen all kinds of stuff on exhibit, but seeing Roman ruins in the place where they had been was entirely different. And I had this feeling of temporal vertigo, where suddenly I was, you know, it was like turning around and looking and discovering that you were at the top of a very, very high cliff or a really tall building, and seeing, you know, that there was a whole lot of stuff, you know, behind you, a whole lot of time. And it was the first time I'd ever really felt that kind of history thing. I guess I call it a, you know, history vertigo.
What I find weird is when I go around London or other parts of Britain, the things that make me react are not the real historical things, but the things that I associate with fiction. So I was being taken on a tour of Lincoln's Inn Fields. I'm going, is that where Jarndyce versus Jarndyce would have been argued, you know? And yeah. I was at Oxford College, and they said, at Oxford University, for a conference, and they said, oh, the college has said we can use the quad during the lunch break. And I go out on the quad, and I suddenly see a sign that says Balliol College, and I suddenly realize I am standing on the lawn where Lord Peter Wimsey was always to be found laying down the law to some unfortunate undergraduate. Not all the historical people who went to Balliol College, but Lord Peter Wimsey was here. And it's just, you know, it's absurd, yeah. You know. But yeah. That's what I read growing up.
It's like going to Graceland.
Yeah.
Well, but Elvis
which I've never been to.
But Elvis was a real person. And what I'm talking about is fictional people.
But I don't know. Was Elvis really a real person?
I'm sure Elvis sometimes wondered. Yeah, I remember reading where Janis Joplin was in a party, and she was getting ready to go on stage. She said, "Well, I got to go put Janis on now. She's upstairs in a trunk."
Well, any performer has an act of some sort, yeah. even if their act appears to be being themselves.
Yeah.
I remember doing a couple of gigs fairly close together in New Jersey and New York, and there was somebody who was at both of them, and he said, "You know, when I saw you the first time, I thought everything you said was something you had just thought up that moment. And then I saw the second gig and realized that actually a lot of it was stuff you said frequently."
Well, I think podcasters have a kind of thing like that. I'm only dressed from the waist up because the camera limits the range of view. So, yeah, we all have our little secrets.
Well, sports broadcaster Bud Collins, who was famous for putting tennis on television, used to walk around. You know, he wore a very sober sort of jacket and tie and a shirt, white shirt or whatever on the top. But when the cameras, like when the BBC cameras caught him and caught his whole body, he was wearing these very huge flowered pants.
You know, I can understand that. You know, it's like if you spend any amount of time in a TV studio, it's so hot. You know, it's like you couldn't. I don't know how people manage, you know, to spend so much time under the hot lights. It's really difficult. And of course,
they've gotten cooler.
Yeah. Oh well, I'm glad to hear that. But
well, because they're not the same lights anymore. You know.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
And also, some people are more. Some people have more trouble with heat than others. You know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm still very resistant to the fact that I might have to get dressed to talk on the phone.
Yeah. I mean, that's all these video calls that, you know, I'm so glad we didn't have that technology when my mother was alive, because she would have been mortally offended to discover the things I was doing while she was talking to me. But, you know, speaking of things that I'm surprised, I was surprised that people were still doing novelizations, because I always read that, you know, the book industry is cratering. So you think, well, isn't everybody watching video now?
Well, you hear the book industry is cratering, but actually, you know, it never really does, particularly during COVID. You know, it's like when people couldn't go out and do anything else. And there are 500 channels, but there was still nothing on. Books kind of, you know, books had a great few years there. And yeah, you know, it's like you can carry your favorite movie or TV show around on your phone and look at it. But they haven't gotten past the how fast it eats up the battery. So, you know, it's like if you can take your movie or TV show with you, but you have to decide if you are going to, you know, if you're going to want to use up that much of your battery and still be able to get phone calls. And that's the other thing that I have problems with. I hate the fact that my phone runs down, you know, so quickly compared to what my old flip phone used to do. You know, it's like if I had to charge it once a week, that was a big deal.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of everything analog, and I always irritate John doing that, because John's the digital guy and I'm surrounded by all sorts of analog stuff. But if I put on camera number two there, you could see what I'm surrounded by, and I just love it. I've got record albums that go back to my childhood. I never got rid of a single one. It's all vinyl and 45s, reel to reel tapes. And I love the radio, because I worked in radio for a long time. But radio is being endangered. Particularly local rural radio stations are going to disappear because there's no one that wants to support them, and the business of getting news out to rural populations is going to go away if they do it. Because there's, you know, President Trump is saying that, well, we've got digital, so they can just get this news and the alarms and weather reports online. But
We saw how well that worked.
Yeah, when we had our big ice storm, the only thing I had that had any kind of information on it was a little battery-operated AM radio.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, the problem is that we have to depend on persistence of electricity, and it may not be persistent. There may be a time when it's disrupted. And that was our experience here during the snowpocalypse that Scoop was just mentioning. Electricity was out, water was out. We got electricity back pretty quickly where I live, but mm-hmm. there were other parts of the city where it was, I don't know, I think it was a couple of weeks that some people were without electricity. So it was
very dystopian in that time because even the cell phones, our cell phone service went under because they had no power to the cell towers. So people relying on their cell phones, you're going, well, no one's there.
Yeah, well, that, you know, being cut off from electricity, you know, is like, that really worries me because I, you know, I'm very connected with online. I do my research, you know, I depend on having access to the web for news, of course, but for a lot of research. And also for, you know, being able to order ebooks. Ebooks have, I love ebooks simply because you can take 1,000 of them on in your carry-on, you know, in the airplane, and it doesn't affect your weight limit. But I always used to get stopped because I had too many books that made my carry-on too heavy.
But the first time I ever went backpacking, I filled my backpack with, I think I had 32 pounds of books.
Mm-hmm.
Not smart. And how many of those books did I read while I was backpacking? Not even one.
No. Yeah, but you might have wanted to read, and if you'd been caught without a book, wanting to read, you know, it's like, it's so much better to have them and not need them rather than need them and not have them.
Agatha Christie wrote a book once about a woman who was trapped in a Middle Eastern oasis desert, in the middle of the desert somewhere, and she'd read the only books that she had with her. And she had nothing else to do, so she started thinking about her life and saw it in a completely different way. And it was actually kind of an interesting book. But, you know, the horror of being without books.
Yeah.
And then there's that Twilight Zone episode with Burgess Meredith where he's the guy that, you know, everybody was gone. There'd been a total apocalypse, but he was left and he was at the library and he loved books and he was going to be able to read for the rest of his life. And then he broke his glasses.
Watching that made me go out and get a second pair of glasses.
Well, I remember sitting in front of the TV yelling, "Go to the optometrist shop."
And now you know why when I had to have cataract surgery, I told the surgeon I wanted to be optimized for reading without glasses.
Yeah.
They want to correct your distance vision. And I'm going, no. I want to make sure I can always read.
Yeah. And owe it all to Burgess Meredith.
Yeah, imagine.
And Rod Serling.
Yeah. So.
So, Pat, how about artificial intelligence? It seems to me that the thing we're calling artificial intelligence isn't exactly like the things that science fiction writers envisioned in
Well,
the
what we
past.
wanted was artificial intelligence so that it would figure out how to do all the shit that we didn't want to do, and so that we could, spend all our time reading and writing. And that's what we had in mind. And it's like I'm not even quite clear on how people are using what they're calling AI, because I just haven't touched it. I haven't used Chat GPT or anything else. And I noticed for a while there, it's like writers were getting all these notifications that their work was being, fed to AI so that AI would learn. And nobody fed anything of mine to it. So I'm hiding out, and I'm gonna take it on as a guerrilla warfare. It's like it's AI is not ready for me. It hasn't met me. So.
Yeah, there have been some interesting discussions about AI and copyright, and the question about whether letting an AI read your book in order to feed its knowledge base is a violation of your or an infringement of your copyright. And I'm not completely sure about that. I mean, the AI.
Well, I'm not either, and that might get me, lynched by my colleagues. But how is an AI supposed to know anything if you don't let it know anything?
I was at a meeting last week, a workshop on AI and copyright, and the conclusion we all reached was that copyright is the wrong tool. So there's some people, John, I can introduce you to if you're interested.
Yeah, what does that mean exactly that copyright is the
Well,
wrong
a
tool?
lot of what we're objecting to is the large companies that are extracting everything from everything. And that's not necessarily the same question as whether people should be allowed to use copyrighted material to train models, I think was really the gist.
There was a talk I went to, somebody was talking about creating a content commons kind of approach. But I don't have complete clarity about how that would work. It's definitely, I mean, we have a lot of controversies about AI now, but the people that I encounter who are talking about artificial intelligence just know that they don't like it. They just don't
Except the
like
ones
it.
who are convinced it's all going to kill us.
Well, and then there are some people who think it's great.
I don't believe that for a minute. It's like when anyone talks about AI, they talk about, it's like the killer colossus model of AI, where it decides that people are just too inefficient and stupid to bother with. But what we've seen is AI producing briefs for court for lawyers with made up references, cases that don't exist. And
I love that.
I'm wondering, how did the program how did the programming work on that? That somehow the AI decided the best thing to do is if you don't have the court case to reference, just make it up.
It's apparently being very literal. It's been told to get the answer, and they're going to do it, one way or another, and the other way is to make it up or hallucinate the answer. The
Well,
big
oh, get the
yeah, there's
answer.
just
It
there's not
doesn't
a
have to be the
validation
right
step.
answer. Well, it's predicting the next word, so it predicts the next word that it think, thinks is the mo that appears to be have the highest probability that it would be the next word.
And sometimes the next word is jabberwocky, I think.
Or the next word is something that is, you know, not factual.
But the big threat to a lot of artistic folk are the artificial beings that are being created and actually cloning actors who have agreed to it because, you know, they weren't making any money. So they've allowed their personality, their look, and their mannerisms to be scanned and incorporated into an artificial version of themselves that could be used by a movie company. You know, why hire a real person when you can just get, you know, you can rent this artificial body?
Actually, the bigger threat at the moment seems to be to voice actors. They seem to be the first in the firing line.
Yeah. Well, the fraud and deep fake, you know, deep fake has potential for all kinds of fraud, from framing someone for a crime to revenge porn to all kinds of things. And I'm surprised, actually, that there hasn't been more of it.
Yeah, there's this sort of, it's a little bit horrifying, I guess, that there are these systems that allow people to create nude versions of people that they just know. Like you feed the image of the girl down the block into the AI, and it produces a very realistic nude of this person. Mm-hmm. And then they're sharing those online. And I mean, I'm not exactly sure how to even characterize that. It seems like what would be the best adjective for that?
I don't know, but here's another thought. Kiddie porn. Is kiddie porn a crime if there are no kiddies?
Yes.
I think so too.
No,
but,
no, I don't mean, it's not an opinion. It's the law actually says that.
Oh, good.
It is actually illegal.
A different kind of crime, though. If you're using a representation, it's not, you haven't actually, what would be the word for molested? You haven't actually done something to an actual child. So that's one kind of crime.
Well, the thing is, lots of people who have collected child pornography haven't done anything to a child, but because there's a demand for child pornography, people do things to children, and you know, it's not a victimless crime. But if it becomes something that that you can do without hurting anyone, but I'm glad to hear that there's a statute, although I think there's going to be a lot of testing.
It's been in the law for a long time. Mm-hmm. because people, I mean, people were able to make Photoshop images and stuff long mm-hmm. ago. This came up in the 90s. It's been the law since then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they passed revenge porn laws in a lot of states, and I think that some of the more recent legislation from on the national level has covered that, because it was a way of people getting their hands on some, you know, someone's sex tape, and then, you know, blackmailing them or just putting it out there just to publicly humiliate them.
Yeah.
The message there is, don't let anybody tape your sex acts.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't, you know, there are two, my mother told me that there were two things that you never wanted to see being made. One was sausages and the other was love.
I don't know. It's, you know, there's so many weird possibilities that could emerge from AI, but I think that we just touched on the most difficult set, really.
Yeah.
I'm not clear, for instance, that that we've defined exactly what laws apply to something like creating a simulated nude of someone, you know, again, mm-hmm. without their permission.
Well, imitating the voice of the Secretary of State is a bit of a step over the line there, because a lot of people fell for that. It was just a faked up, you know, phone call.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and what law applies to that? I'm just not sure what the laws are, whether there needs to be a mm-hmm. new set of laws mm-hmm. that pertain to a world with artificial intelligence.
It gets difficult because if you make a law making it, if you try to make a law that makes it illegal to disseminate misinformation, then what happens when people make genuine mistakes and who one person's misinformation is another person's, oh my God, this has got to be true.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the thing is, we have seen, you know, some results from that. The famous Pizzagate, where, you know, this guy had heard that, you know, children were being, you know, molested and killed in the basement of a pizzeria by Hillary Clinton. So being a good moral man, he tooled up, he got in his truck and he went to, you know, do something about it. And he got to the pizza parlor and there wasn't even a seller.
But the emails.
Yes, yes. But Hunter Biden's laptop. Hillary. You know, it's like, oh, I have a feeling that a large portion of the population is going to be so busy arguing back and forth about emails and who was in the wrong that they may well starve, you know.
I thought it was all Jeffrey Epstein now.
Oh, God.
It is at the moment, but I'm seeing a whole new realm of law potentially emerging here.
Yeah, I, you know, it's like I can see, my God, you know, it's like if I were a young person now, I would be very, very tempted to go into law because it's a whole new, it's like being on another planet.
I go to a conference every year called We Robot, which is a conference for lawyers trying to work out, they're writing papers that get discussed about mm-hmm. Law and AI and robotics and so on. And it's always very interesting because they are actually trying to figure out what direction policy should go and what kinds of laws we're going to need in the future. And they're trying to do it in advance so that we don't have bad law that sticks and we don't have 25 years of the same discussion over and over again because yeah. they're solving the problems. It's a very good event.
Yeah, it sounds like it. It sounds really interesting.
You would love it.
I don't know whether it's a law or
send you
a custom
my write-ups
or a rule, but we have reached the end. We have reached the end of our hour.
The end of the internet is here.
No, just the end of this road. But there's a universe full of others. And I, as always, I've enjoyed coming on and talking to you guys. See you next time.
Okay,
we'll see you then. Bye-bye.
Okay.
You can stay in touch with Plutopia at plutopia.io. On Facebook, look for @Plutopia News. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.